Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of In the Garden, right here on KFSK. I'm your host, Daniel Rowan Tucker. On this show, we dig our hands in the dirt, get back to nature, and find that special place of abundance and beauty. Shipping costs are on the rise as petroleum supply disruptions in the Middle East make themselves felt around the world through higher fuel prices. My wife and I recently noticed this on our bulk orders from Azure Standard, an 18% increase on shipping dry goods and a 30% increase on shipping chilled and frozen goods. With our position at the far end of every supply chain except for timber and fish, you can bet we're going to be feeling those changes here in Petersburg. But the silver lining of inflation is that it can incentivize local production, and that's what we're looking at in today's episode. You might think that farming is something that just doesn't happen here in this land of steep forested mountains, soggy muskegs, and bouldery beaches, but that's not the whole story. From Hungry Point, you can look across Frederick Sound to a place called Point Agassiz, 9 miles to the north of Petersburg on the mainland shore at the foot of tall, ice-clad mountains. Point Agassiz is one of a small handful of areas in southeast Alaska where you can find flat, well-drained, arable land, and it was for a time in the early 20th century a significant source of food production for the town of Petersburg, being home to several homestead farms. It's also amazingly beautiful, with broad swaths of wildflowers growing in wide meadows flanked by massive spruce trees, opening out onto an endless beach with views all the way to Admiralty Island. This unique landscape was formed when a huge glacier flowing down from the mountains into the sea left a wide deposit of sand, gravel, and silt in days gone by, and it forms a flat, fan-shaped expanse about 5 miles across at its widest point, from Clear Creek at the north end down to Brown Cove at the south, punctuated by a few small hills and the mouth of the Muddy River. The soils of Point Agassiz are completely different from the soils we find around Petersburg. The town of Petersburg, as most of you are aware who live here, was built on and around a large muskeg, meaning that many of our homes still sit on top of peat deposits that may be 10, 15, even 20 feet deep. In some cases, with pilings going, hopefully, all the way down to the hard stuff down underneath all that peat. And this causes all kinds of unique challenges, especially for gardening. Soggy peat, even once drainage has been established by gravel roads coming through and other construction efforts, it's really hard to grow a lot of things in that wet soil. It's a big limiting factor. So at Point Agassiz, there's this deep, deep deposit of sand and cobbly, pebbly gravel. A lot of cobbles up to about fist size and occasionally larger, but mostly sand and pebbles. And then occasional pockets of silt. But the silt seems to be, the silt and clay seems to be in these kind of shallow lenses. And there's almost always deeper deposits of sand and gravel underneath of that. So there's good drainage, and that allows plants to have a much higher rate of growth. And you'll notice the spruce trees over there are growing very fast. Some of them, 36 inches in diameter at the butt, at breast height off the ground at only 50 years old. So really big increments on those growth rings. As any forester will appreciate, very fast growing trees and lush meadow grasses and plants, lots of wild celery and Nootka lupin and chocolate lily and nagoon berries sometimes to be found, the elusive nagoon berry. Really unique habitat. And these uplift meadows are a distinct ecosystem that's recognized by ecologists in southeast Alaska, folks like Richard Carstensen and Robert Armstrong and their other collaborators on a really great book called The Nature of Southeast Alaska. They specifically describe the uplift meadows, which only occur in a few scattered places, Point Agassiz, Mendenhall Valley, Gustavus area, these places where the snout of a big glacier dropped a huge deposit and then retreated, and we get this rapid rate of glacial uplift, or isostatic rebound, as it's also known. And so the land is rising up out of the sea because it's the Earth's crust beneath it is actually rebounding slowly but surely from the weight of all that thousands of feet of ice that was sitting on top of it. You know, think about like a waterbed or a trampoline in slow motion, kind of slowly coming back up. And so at Point Agassiz, and this is in effect all over Southeast, but the rate is even greater in these particular areas where massive glaciers were most recently. The whole area was covered, all of Southeast nearly was covered in ice sheets, some 10,000 years ago, but then even more recently, probably within the last 2,000, maybe even 1,000 years ago, these glaciers were at places like Point Agassiz and Gustavus. So the rate of uplift is quite rapid, something like half an inch to an inch a year, at Point Agassiz. And you can see, also because it's so flat, that little bit of elevation increase causes, dramatic changes. And you can see old driftwood logs covered with moss with trees growing out of them, in the woods in places where, you know, it was a beachfront or a slough only 50 years ago, and the logs would float in on a big high tide and get left there. And then a few years later, the tide no longer got quite up to there, and that driftwood log just sat there, and then trees started growing on it. And so these uplift meadows are very dynamic because they're one of the few non-forested habitats that we have here in Southeast, but not because it's not productive enough for trees, just because the trees haven't colonized it as fast as the grasses and meadow plants. And the trees are slowly moving in, and there's this very dynamic relationship between the meadows and the forest. And another big factor of that is that at Point Agassiz, in particular, we know that the meadows were burned in the past, in the mid-20th century. We'll get into that farming history in a little bit. And that held the trees back more. Since then, the burning has stopped, and the trees are encroaching more and more. But at the same time, out on the beach, the uplift is continuing, and there's these wide meadows where the upper intertidal zone grows all kinds of grasses and sedges, and that gradually uplifts and transitions to wildflower meadows, and the lupin and wild celery start coming in, and it's really beautiful. It's really unique. There's tons of birds, lots of shorebirds, migrating waterfowl love to stop there, sometimes sandhill cranes. Really amazing ecosystem. And that was part of what drew some local farmers there in the early 20th century. And here I'd like to share some excerpts from a really excellent write-up on the history of Point Agassiz that was put together by Ann Lee, curator over at the Clausen Museum. This is called Recollections of Point Agassiz, and you can get it from the museum as a print booklet or as a PDF, and highly recommend it for anyone who's interested in the history of that area, especially if you have family ties there, property over there. Really cool stuff to know about. So, and I quote, "The territory of Alaska was an organized, incorporated territory of the United States from August 24, 1912, until statehood was granted on January 3, 1959. The 1862 Homestead Act allowed any American to put in a claim for up to 160 free acres of federal land for the price of a small filing fee. It was required that the head of the household be at least 21 years of age and to certify that they had never borne arms against the United States. After filing on the land, a surveyor would be sent out to establish corner posts and meanders. Once the application receipt was in their possession, the homesteaders could begin the process of proving up on the land. This required them to live on the land, build a home, make improvements, and farm for 5 years. When this was accomplished, they would need to find two neighbors or friends willing to vouch for the truth of his or her statements about the improvements to the land and to sign the proof document. After the completion of this file form and the $6 payment, the homesteader would receive the patent for the land, signed with the name of the current president of the United States, and they would be entitled to keep their claim free and clear. This paper represented the culmination of years of hard work and dedication. And just a note here, Colin Lyons, who lives here in Petersburg, has told me the land patent for their family property, now in the hands of the Lyons family. I believe it was originally homesteaded by his great-grandfather, who was a Hollingstad, and it's signed by President Woodrow Wilson. And land patents generally are something really interesting to know about. It's a form of land title that is the strongest form of title. It usually, in the, this day and age, usually the title has become other forms, such as a warranty deed or a quitclaim deed, but the land patent is the strongest, clearest form of title. And I have been told that in Alaska it's still relatively easy to obtain a land patent for your property, wherever it may be, if you can establish a clear chain of title down through the various times it changed hands since it was first claimed or homesteaded or granted from the state. So something interesting to look into for those of you who own land or any form of real estate. So the very first homestead at Point Agassiz was, from what I've read, established by Carl Swanson in 1918 with the intention to start farming there. Although there was plenty of seafood and venison, there was very little fresh food available in Petersburg. The homesteaders made a living raising cattle, sheep, goats, chickens, geese, and vegetables on the rich sandy soil of the area. Milk, butter, cheese, beef, eggs, and produce were brought over to Petersburg for barter and sale. The milk cans would be left in sheds by the road, and the truck, usually driven by Carl Swanson or Edward Ramstead Sr., would pick them up and take them to Petersburg daily or every other day. Payment was made pretty much on consignment and was made in groceries or other supplies at shops such as the Sanitary Market. In 1921, John Hammer and Andrew Wecon started their business, Petersburg Dairy. They bought the milk from the Point Agassiz farmers for 10 cents a quart and sold it in town for 15 cents. They hauled it to town in 5-gallon cans, bottled the milk, and sold it from their small store and bottle washing shed, located at the present site of Anchor Properties. In 1924, the partners bought the lot where the original Hammer and Wecon building still stands. They constructed the new building and ran their business there until 1926, when they changed their name and discontinued the dairy business to concentrate on the grocery line. Nettie Martinson had the only dairy in Petersburg, which offered an excellent but limited milk supply. And as another side note, the old Martinson Dairy, I believe, used to stand along North Nordic near where the... there's a large home there that kind of looks like a gingerbread house. On that property, I believe they used to have a large barn, from what folks have told me, and the Martinson cows were sometimes grazed up Petersburg Creek, during that time period. In the early 1930s, Dean Kaler discussed with Nettie his idea of starting a new business, and a meeting was called with the Point Agassiz farmers. The plan was for him to buy the milk, pay cash, and then he would sell all the milk. This met with complete approval of Mrs. Martinson and the other farmers. At home on 3rd Street, bottles were washed, boiled in a tub on the wood stove, cooled, filled, and capped. From there, Dean would carry wooden crates to his customers and deliver the milk on their doorsteps, as the ad stated, before breakfast. Soon help was needed, and the good and faithful workers, Dave Omer and John Robert Otness, were hired. As business progressed, a contract was made with the Alaska Steamship Company for a delivery to be made when the ships docked. Soon the need for more space was apparent, and thus the move was made to a downtown location in the Telephone Exchange Building. There was just a small counter with an icebox in the corner. At any time, fishermen would come to the back door and say, "Dean, we're going out, need milk." Dean had a deep desire to become part of the fishing business. He followed his dream, and Dean C. Kaler Seafoods was born. This necessitated selling the creamery when Lloyd Swanson became the new owner. And I believe Dean Kaler later became Kaler Dahl Seafoods, which some of you may have heard of. So back at Point Agassiz, drinking water was collected in barrels from rain on the roof or a small dam up Bear Slough. The well water was unpalatable due to the strong smell and taste of sulfur, though the animals didn't mind it. The Swansons had a bricked-in well and first-class good drinking water. The agriculture at most of the farms involved truck gardening, the raising of vegetables for market, potatoes, rutabagas, turnips, carrots, horseradish, parsnips, and many varieties of greens and berries. The gardens were fertilized with seaweed and starfish. An underground root cellar was an essential way to keep food from freezing in the winter and cool in the summer. Root cellars were dug underneath the house to a depth of 4 or 5 feet. The vegetables were placed in the cavity and then covered with sand, which had been spread and aired outside until it was bone dry. In this way, food would keep all winter. In 1942, the estimated total amount of food raised at the settlement was 8 tons of potatoes, 7 tons of rutabaga, and a half ton of carrots, cabbage, and small garden products. Additionally, an estimated 10 tons of beef and lamb were raised, and 50 gallons of tallow were saved from butchering to be donated to the Red Cross and shipped outside for vital war uses. Folks, I know a lot of folks today are turning on to the uses of beef tallow as a skincare product, so keep that in mind. 50 gallons of tallow they saved, and that was donated to the Red Cross at that time. The farmers would burn their fields, their pastures and hay fields, to release nitrogen from the straw stubble back into the soil. And this is something that everyone I've talked to who lives over there mentions, because the meadows there used to be a lot more open and treeless, because this burning also helped to keep down the invasion of spruce trees into those meadows, the grasses being able to regrow after the burn, whereas the little spruce seedlings would get killed off by the fire. And so it was a very important management tool, and kind of an interesting side note is that that kind of intentional burning was practiced by native peoples up and down the West Coast, down in Puget Sound, places like the San Juan Islands. The whole islands were regularly burned off, and the indigenous Salish people there created these amazing gary oak savannas covered with wildflowers. They grew a lot of food in the form of camas and other root crops there, and it was amazing habitat for deer and other game animals. And so it's very interesting that this kind of parallel practice of burning took place up here at Point Agassiz for a little while. You know, kind of ties into the ancient roots of agriculture and land management, all over the world. And, continuing on that, there was, a really great talk at the library this past Friday at lunchtime, a fellow by the name of Fred Sharp, who lives down in the Puget Sound area in Squim, I believe, and he is involved with a lot of ecological work around these unique rain shadow ecosystems that they have down there in that dry zone around the San Juan Islands, and the unique wildflower meadows that were historically burned, and they're coming back to prescribed burning. He's up here in Southeast for the summer, and he talked about how up around Haines there's a little bit of a kind of parallel Mediterranean or pseudo-Mediterranean zone there, where they get a bit less rain in the summer, being back up in the mountains there on the Chilkat Valley, and they have these dry rock outcrops that is too dry for trees to grow on, and very interesting little kind of pocket of semi-Mediterranean climate. And he was very interested to hear about Point Agassiz and the history of burning there. So I'm hoping that we'll see him back in town at some point. And he recommended to folks that are interested in learning more about the ecosystems of our area or that do biological work, things like that, to check out the Chilkat Biodiversity Forum coming up on May 4th up in Haines. Sounds like a really neat gathering. So anyways, the farmers at Point Agassiz were burning off their pastures and hayfields, maintaining this big, wide, open space where they could graze their cattle and make hay. And we have a quote here from Glenn Ramstead. And so the Ramstead family was one of the original homesteading families there, and they were actually in-laws with the Swansons. Carl Swanson's wife, Aurora, was the sister of Ed Ramstead Sr.'s wife, Ida, I believe. And so their son, Glenn, was much later interviewed, and he says, the hay to feed cattle grew wild there and was very lush and nutritious. Generally, no supplemental feeding was ever required for a healthy herd. When, by 1932, our herd was at a total of about 50, we used to harvest approximately 150 tons of wild hay, namely timothy, clover, tricorner, red top, and ryegrass. And so that's a very interesting statement to hear, that they were able to feed those cattle and those dairy cattle without relying on any significant source of supplemental feeding from outdoors. Dairy cattle have pretty high nutritional requirements producing all that milk. And we know that those cattle were also grazing out on the beach. There's another story I've seen about how their cows would sometimes get stranded out on a sandbar and have to swim back to shore. But they had this one old lead cow named Dolly who had a tide book in her head, so they said, and would lead the cows back up to the high ground. But you can be sure they were nibbling on kelp and those salty, mineral-rich intertidal grasses and succulent plants, and probably really good for the health of the cattle and for their milk production. So that's just a little snippet about the history of Point Agassiz. Later on, the farmers mostly left. The changing socioeconomic landscape of the mid-20th century made it hard to compete with cheaper food coming up from down south on the steamers. Price of fuel was very cheap at that time, and also a lot of new regulations, farming regulations, were being framed by the industrial agricultural interests intentionally to push out the little guys. Pasteurization became the law, and the small farmers out at Point Agassiz could see that they would have a really hard time keeping up with that and competing with all the cheap food from down south, and being required to put in things like concrete floors in their milking parlors and pasteurize everything. And well, we're starting to come full circle now, and a lot more folks are recognizing the health benefits of raw milk. And so it's a very interesting time. Food is getting a lot more expensive. Inflation just seems to keep going up and up. Fuel costs are going up. Food quality has gone down dramatically, and finding really good food is something that more and more people recognize is really crucial to being in good health, and especially the health of our children. And so, knowing about the history of what was done at Point Agassiz, what is possible there, I think is really inspiring and really good to know about in this day and age. And, there's still folks raising animals over there. Victor and Tabitha Nelson have a herd of Nigerian dwarf dairy goats that they breed and sell, make available. They ship their animals all over Alaska. Another branch of the Nelson family raises golden retrievers. Wonderful, wonderful dogs. Have one myself. In somewhat recent history, the Bell family had a herd of cattle over there and, a couple of horses, and the Nelsons had horses too. The Bell's cows, kind of went feral, and I hear rumors sometimes, people citing them, up around Thomas Bay, around the mouth of the Muddy River. They may be out there somewhere. So if you're at Point Agassiz, keep your eyes peeled for some feral cows. Another interesting chapter of the history. But, Point Agassiz is a really fabulous resource for our community, and still mostly locally owned. Definitely something we should be grateful for and think about taking advantage of. That's all for this week, folks. And a note to our listeners, feel free to drop me an email if you have any questions, comments, or topic suggestions for the show. That's daniel@icefieldfarm.com, D-A-N-I-E-L at I-C-E-F-I-E-L-D-F-A-R-M.com. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening. Until next week, this has been In the Garden, right here on KFSK.